It's really an honor for me to speak to you this week, and I am so surprised that I would be asked to do this. I was really swamped with nostalgia as I walked through the library about 30 minutes ago and remembered my few years here that seemed like an eternity while I was here, but it's gone by so fast. I don't know most of you personally, but I think I'm quite familiar with the world in which you live. And I have in mind pastors when I say that. There are many of you who have come to this conference who find yourself somewhat down and discouraged. You don't have the time for these meetings, but you've chosen to take the time for them. And I commend you for that. You struggle, as I do, with feelings of inadequacy, and on occasion, you get terribly close to the idea of quitting. One of the best-kept secrets of this conference may be your own loneliness. It's lonely to be a leader, and I know that feeling, too. You're overworked and you're underpaid. Chances are good that the board is not meeting while you're away making plans to increase your salary also. They might be meeting for other reasons, but not for that reason. Came across an interesting little piece on how to get rid of a pastor. I thought it might be a good way to get things started. Sort of on the same level. There's a new chain letter going around among churches in which no cost is involved. You just send a copy of the letter to six other churches that are tired of their ministers. Then you bundle up your pastor and send him to the church at the bottom of the list. In 1 week, you will receive 16,436 preachers. And one of them should be a dandy. But beware, one church broke the chain and got their old minister back. In the midst of all of the involvements of your life, along with other battles, you've got to put up with people that come on the air and have all the answers. And weird guys from California, of all places, who have the audacity of invading your parish and trying to instruct your people. If I ever felt close to C.S. Lewis, I felt close to him when I went kicking and screaming into a radio ministry. I literally had to be forced to do it. And I sometimes wonder if it was that wise a decision. It is an enormous responsibility. I have my wife to thank for the success of it. No questions asked. She is brilliant in the whole field of the media. She is the executive director of the ministry, and if it's ministered to you and to your folks, and I really hope it has, I really have to say she's the one who gets the credit. I wish she were here for me to introduce her to you, but she will join me on Wednesday for the marathon. Very good. Now, I want the stuff that I say not to sound too scholarly, because you get a whole pack of that for 4 years, but the stuff that I say to have a realism about it. So I've dreaded this long enough to know that I'm going to have to just be me. You're going to have to let that happen. And I'm going to have to say things as I feel comfortable saying them, as if I were right at home talking to our own folks. I've got a couple of subjects that are of my own choosing, I'm glad to say, and they have to do with a couple of bottom line areas of ministry, namely the home and the pulpit. These are two areas that I give a good deal of attention and time to, and therefore I feel comfortable speaking to you about them. I want you to look at 1 Timothy chapter 3, and then in a few minutes we're going to go over to Ephesians chapter 4. And I have in mind especially the relationship that we as pastors sustain with our wives. I want to be very candid as I speak, both during our sessions in the mornings and at the banquet. I want to feel that you and I are in touch with each other. I do not want you to leave thinking something phony or erroneous. I want you to leave correctly assuming the things of my life and of my family's life. And so some of the things I will say will be sort of a popular exposition rather than a detailed exposition. And it will be in some ways a bit of a confession to all of you about life. By the way, I was interested in coming across a statistic that was a bit surprising. This author has done an extensive job of research through questionnaires with ministers all around the country. And she discovered that the average length of time a pastor spends in a given parish is 3 to 5 years. Doesn't seem very long to me, though I have spent 2 years in one pastorate and 4 in another. As I look back, I really am not sure that that much was accomplished during that brief period of time, though there are always extenuating circumstances that may push you on earlier than you would have planned. But this is the part that surprised me. It's generally known that 20% of the American population moves each year. Traditionally, pastors have transferred more often than those in other professions. There are several hundred thousand pastors serving parishes in the United States. A conservative estimate is that 25% move annually, or well over 100 pastors a day. Some religious leaders believe that 1/3 would be a more accurate figure, or nearly 200 pastors moving every day of every year. You may be seriously thinking about moving. You may be in process, or you may have just moved. Chances are good that your ministry has been, and certainly it will be, greatly affected by your home. Even though it's tough for some men in ministry to admit that. In this third chapter of 1 Timothy, we have a list of extreme requirements for the man of God. You've worked through the list, and so have I. In fact, I'm right now in Sunday evenings teaching 1 Timothy and just finished the first 7 verses of this third chapter. So it's fresh on my mind. But when I get to verses 4 and 5, I'm really taken back with the significance of them. Speaking of the overseer, he must be one who manages his own household well. keeping his children under control with all dignity. And then that parenthetical but strong warning. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? This is the only reference to management in all the lists of the New Testament regarding an overseer. Titus 1, 1 Peter 5, 1 Timothy 3, and others. This is the only one that addresses management. And interestingly, it does not go to the business world and say, look at how the man did in business, and then you'll have an idea of how he'll do in the church. Even though business seems to be the sine qua non of management or management skills where they're in operation. But he says in looking at the man who is to serve as an overseer, elder, pastor, whatever, look at his home. Take a close look at the way things are handled between him and his wife. How's that management? And him and his children. How are those things? You know what I think? I think you want your home to be a model of your life and of your ministry. I think you want it strong. I'm not blowing smoke on you when I say that. I think you really want a home that's solid. And I think if the truth were known, some of you have a deep struggle in this relationship. It sometimes starts right here at Dallas Seminary. This place isn't known for giving you lots of time to cultivate a relationship with your family, though I'm convinced this place believes in such. And so you have to kind of do it piecemeal. You've got to negotiate with your family. I remember sitting in a carrel over in Mosier Library and looking out the window when I was working the summer between my third and fourth year on my thesis, and looking at a little boy playing in the yard there at the little campus apartments. You don't have them now, thank God, but they were here then. And I'm not saying the walls were thin, but I would tell my wife a joke and Peggy Schneider next door would laugh. That's how things were. A lot of benefits, hot and cold running rats, a lot of things that you could enjoy at campus apartments. And I remember looking out the carrel, out the window and seeing a little boy who bore my name and my wife, and they playing together and eating my heart out in a real sense that I couldn't be there enjoying that with them. I know where you're coming from. I know the anxiety. I know the frustration. I don't know a lot of answers for you right now. But I know it means a whole lot to your family to know that that does eat your heart out. That is a concern to you. You're starting your management skills right now. And I want to affirm your commitment to your home. Let me let you into a little slice of my life that isn't public knowledge. Back in 1955, an 18-year-old girl and a 20-year-old young man said, I do, in the outskirts of Houston. Cynthia Parker and Chuck Swindoll. And she had no idea what she was getting into when she did that. This June will be 29 years we have lived together. And it's been tough. There have been times that both of us in our growing up stages, and I think that keeps going on, there have been times when we wondered if we were cut out for each other. There have been times when I had to face the fact that I was a smotherer in my love, and I was a clutcher, and I was a keeper, and I had all the verses to back it up. And she didn't even have to ask me for references. I gave them on a rather regular basis. Tough times. And you learn how to handle that kind of management battle, I hope. And there are no rules that someone can give you. You learn the hard way. You learn the arguments and the difficulties and the strain of those times, how to manage your family. Don't stop learning how to do that. Last week I had a friend tell me about a man who just was greatly struggling with his home and decided to take a long walk, and he was so depressed, and he got all the way to the street corner and stood there at a red light and just tapped his foot and leaned against the post and just thought, am I going to go on or not? And suddenly he looked up and there were two black hearses that pulled up at the stop sign, stoplight right in front of him. One hearse, another hearse. And strangely, behind the second hearse, about 45, 50 men standing, walking in step. Seized with curiosity, he walked over and tapped on the window of the hearse at the front. And the guy rolled the window down. And he says, yes. He says, well, what is this? Well, he said, in this coffin is my wife, and in that coffin is my mother-in-law. And suddenly a big dog stuck his head up, and he said, this dog killed both of them. And the guy said, can I borrow that dog? And the guy in the car said, get in line. I've been in line. I'm not talking on the family because we have it all wired or because the Swindolls have put it all together or because our life is placid and quiet and both of us are so soft-willed that we can just kind of blend into whatever. What a joke. I'm talking on the family because it is the basis of your management skills. And any church that looks at you seriously regarding the pulpit must take a deep look into your home. And they will, if they got it, their stuff together. They will. We interview wives. If the children are old enough, we talk to children. We want to know how things are. We want to know if there are any unresolved conflicts. And if there are, we want to know if they're working on them. We want realism. We're not interested in stamping out cookie-cutter kind of preachers. That's not real. And that's not what changes lives. Neither are we looking for people that have it all together. I get very nervous around those that try to give that impression. Now, from 1 Timothy chapter 3... go back to Ephesians chapter 4, and I want to share with you some of the things that have helped Cynthia and me stay together over these almost 29 years. I want to use the last paragraph in chapter 4 of Ephesians as a basis of my comments. And I want to point out four or five reflections as I think back over these years of ways that we have learned how to live together and stay together. Look at verse 25. Ephesians 4, 25. Therefore, laying aside falsehood, speak truth, each one of you with his neighbor. Do you allow me a little liberty? Speak truth, each one of you with his mate or with her mate. For we are members of one another. I think as I reflect back over our museum of memories for these almost 29 years, As I reflect on our marriage, one of the reasons we have been able to slug it out and keep it together and maintain a sense of harmony is that we have cultivated honesty in our relationship. We have cultivated the ability to speak truth to one another. And that's been hard. But you know the wonderful verse out of John 8, you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Since we have given attention to telling each other the truth, and we didn't for the early part of our marriage, but since we have begun to cultivate a truth relationship, we've been freer with each other. I've been freer in my person. I have sensed a liberty from the Lord in my life, in my ministry, even with my children. I've sensed a freedom to be open and unguarded as I have decided to lay aside falsehood. We don't lie to each other anymore. You know when you're first going together, you lie. Even though you don't call it that. Your wife loves opera. You hate opera. And she says, as you're courting, maybe we could go and hear this opera that's coming up in a couple of... Oh, wonderful. I'll buy the tickets, you say. Even though in your gut, you're not thinking, wonderful. You're thinking, what a drag. And you buy the tickets and you go and you force yourself to enjoy it and you smile all the way through it and act like it's cool and you leave. Oh, wasn't that wonderful? Oh, it's marvelous. And you lie all the way home and you 3 weeks later say, honey, I'd like to go fishing and it's 3:00 in the morning. I'll pick you up. She says, great, I'll fix the sandwiches. She gets up at 2:30. She mixes tuna fish, sandwiches, chips, puts it all together. You get her and you take off and she's sitting there on the lake. It's so dark she can't even see her line, and she says, this is wonderful how we can fish together. And then you get married. Then you get married. It's amazing. When you get married, you suddenly break away from the mask of courtship and you tell the truth. And she starts mentioning opera. You can't wait to have her finish her sentence. So you can say, I'm not going, I don't like opera, never liked opera. And try the fishing number on her a couple of months into marriage. Honesty has to be cultivated. You have to have a sense of caring enough to hear the truth and to let it be said so that you're not impressing any longer. You're learning to live together and you're discovering early on, what really has made you who you are. You know, I lived almost 10 years with my wife and didn't know her. Oh, I knew what color hair she had, and I knew what color eyes she had, and I knew her shape, and I knew her basic likes and dislikes, but I didn't know her deeply. Part of the reason is I didn't give her a lot of room to let me know who she was. It's hard for me to hear the truth. I'll never forget that dark day as we were sitting together, 10 Bruce Road, in Waltham, Massachusetts, in the middle of a pastorate that was tough for me. And she said to me, honey, I think it might be good if you no longer say publicly that we're partners. Because we're not. Man, that was a very, very tough thing to hear. I may have been stubborn, but I wasn't calloused. I remember putting my head down on the kitchen table and I started to cry. I think it took that to get through to me. And we began a rebuilding process that has taken a number of years. Now I can tell you the truth. We are partners. Because we've started telling each other the truth. We've stopped lying. Well, if you keep reading, you'll see that it has something to say about anger. I don't know about your home, but every once in a while, little anger flares up in the Swindoll home. Be angry, and yet do not sin. Don't let the sun go down on your anger, and don't give the devil an opportunity. You probably anticipate what I'm going to say here. Part of the reason we've been able to hold it together for 29 years is that we've developed constructive ways to deal with our anger. We've learned that what God says works. We've learned that there is a way in which anger can be expressed that doesn't move into the realm of sin. There are ways in which we give our anger out, and it sounds like it's okay, but it's not. And I've listed a few. Sarcastic jabs. Public put-downs. Bringing up old events. Emotional and or physical abuse. There's an old Chinese proverb that says, "He who strikes another has run out of ideas." I don't know, as I look out over this group of very dignified-looking people, how many of you are wife abusers, but I think we probably have a few. I hope not. We have discovered in our church in California that we have some wife abusers and we have some child abusers, and we've decided to work with them rather than simply to stand at a distance and throw stones. So we've got support groups going, and we've got some very helpful professionals who are assisting us in this raw edge of life. People who don't know how to handle their anger. Rather than privately talking it through or staying with it until there is agreement on the subject. I mean, when he says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath, we've taken that literally. We have talked until four o'clock in the morning. Believe me, by then, you will give in to anything. Anything. Whatever you say, honey, that's great. Just let me get to sleep. We give up too quick. When the anger comes, we go to bed and set it in concrete. Don't do that. Realize there's conflict going on, and it will take time. Maybe not at this moment can you work with it, but you can before that night is over. Work on it. It is a basic assignment for domestic harmony. Work on the anger until it's resolved. It's hard work. I realized that I used to get mad about things that I really had no right to get mad about. We are different people. I wanted her to be just like me, except a female. I want her to like what I like. I wanted her to like the home as cool as I like it. My wife would just be frozen in weather like this. God bless her. She wakes up cold. She goes to bed cold. The dirtiest place in our home is a little switch under the thermostat that keeps getting moved back and forth and back and forth. She thaws out August 2nd and goes back under August 24th, and we're back into it again. We get double use out of a two-way blanket, electric blanket. I never have mine on, and she has hers on 10. Smoke comes up on her side. And then when she's through and it wears out, then we just flip it over, and she gets that side, and I get the burned-out side. It just makes me mad that she didn't have the kind of thermostat that I had, and that's dumb to get mad about stuff like that. I mean, I'm a sports fan, and my wife has learned to live with some of that. I'm loud and impulsive. That may surprise you. She is quiet and classy. She likes real plants in the house. Real plants. Unbelievable. Plants, you know, are ought to be outside. That's my opinion, but I think you ought to have them plastic. You can just vacuum them and, you know. But she's into real plants, and so I give room for that, and I've learned to give room for that. You say, come on, Swindoll, get scholarly. I am not getting scholarly, because homes don't break up over scholarship. Homes break up over practical things just like this. Now, you guys, wake up. You've got some desperate situations at home, and they're not going to get any better just because you learn more of the language. Now, don't give up on the language, but my goodness, don't live out the home. They need you. They want you. They love you, and they don't know how to get through to you. And then children come along. They're darling children. And you plan on one, and you finally wind up with five. And they're just everywhere. It looks like recess let out. And I'll tell you one thing about seminarians. They're fertile. There are kids all over this place. It's unbelievable. Well, every time you bring another one into this world, you've got another whole realm of responsibility. And that takes time. That takes effort. They didn't ask to be born. You asked them to be born. They've come by your invitation. And that's the way God planned it. And oh, my, do they grow up fast. We just, 3 years ago, saw our son get married. And now they've got a little boy. He was born Christmas Day. Our first grandson. He now types. Bilingual. And our daughter. Boy, we married off our precious older daughter. It's hard to marry off a daughter. It's not too hard to marry a son, you know. But when you marry off a daughter, it's like handing over a $200,000 Stradivarius to a gorilla. You know. Where's this? And with the larger number of children and the enormity of responsibility, that anger builds. And if you're high-powered and you're motivated and you're excited about ministry and life, you just kind of skate right through that water. Just turn it on full. And she'll have to hang on if she wants to ski with us. And she gets angry. And she has a right to get angry. Don't give the devil an opportunity. Believe me, he'll take it. He'll take it. I think as I reflect over 29 years of marriage that third area is that we've learned not to steal from one another. I told you it was confession time, and if I read verse 28 right, Christians can steal. Let him who steals, steal. No longer let him labor, perform. Wait a minute, I didn't read that right. Let him who steals, steal no longer. Rather, let him labor, performing with his own hands what is good, in order that he may have something to share with him who has need. Stealing? Yeah, stealing. For example, stealing time. You promise time, but you don't keep your promise. You've stolen time. Stealing money. You have a joint account. Then it's a joint relationship in which you plan to spend it. She has every right to ask hard questions, and he has the same right, wives, to ask the questions. Stealing trust. You know, in every marriage, there are secrets. Now, track with me here, okay? In every marriage, there are secrets. And those secrets are kept in the vault of each other's lives. You know your beloved and you know your lady better than anybody on earth. You know their fears and you know their scars and you know their background. You know what embarrasses them. My wife could stand and in two sentences embarrass me to tears. She has my trust that she will not do that. She knows the very bad things and she knows a few of the good things. But that trust is in place. Pastors, don't steal from your wife when you preach. Don't steal their trust. Some of the things they tell you will make great illustrations. Great illustrations. Don't you dare. In order to keep from stealing, I notice that one is to labor, performing with his hands what is good. It's very, very hard work to stop stealing. It happens every time I say yes to something, and every time I plan to say no to something, I have to think about stealing. What it will mean to my family if I say yes to that, I'm saying no to them. There are some times we must. It just demands examination. Let me say finally that we are still together because we have learned to deliberately forgive one another quickly and permanently. Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification. Unfortunately, putrid words sometimes come from our tongues. According to the need of the moment, that it may give grace to those who hear, don't grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from your marriage. Let it be put away from your home, along with all malice. Believe me, malice can be a part of a pastor's home. And be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving each other, just as God in Christ has forgiven you. Forgiving. Forgiving. Some time ago, I was overcommitted. I guess all of us have had that same battle. And being overcommitted, I panicked a little. My pride was at stake. I didn't want to write anybody and say I'm not able to fulfill my commitment, so I stayed at it. And I would sort of hit the high places at home, and I'd be back into something else. I had a trip to Venezuela, and I ministered there for 8 days. On the way back, I knew that I had a banquet that night I arrived. Foolish planning. And then 2-3 days later, I was to go to a board meeting at a seminary in the Midwest, and I was really uneasy, really irritable. And so breakfast came. It was a Saturday morning. I'll never forget it. And all the kids were around the table, and Cynthia and I were kind of grunting and, you know, those looks, you know, don't mess with the black widow, meaning me, because he's going to bite you. And Kurt said something, and I nailed him. And Carissa said something, and I nailed her. And Chuck said, everybody be quiet, or Dad'll get on you. And I nailed him, and Cynthia looked at me, and I looked back at her. It was one of those wonderful Christian mornings, and they never put those mornings on the radio, praise God. They never put that on the radio. And so Kurt stood up and said, I'm going to work, boom, and he left. He was working as a maintenance man at cleaning the building for Wycliffe, this missionary organization there on the West Coast. At least we work at the right places. And I was really convicted. I sat there. Everybody got up. Dishes were done. I looked around, and I thought, boy, this is the pits. Here I am, missionary speaker. People want me to talk about the home and the family, and mine's out to lunch. So I said, okay, everybody, let's sit down. So we all kind of did a little powwow, sat down together around the coffee table, all on the floor, put everybody on the same level. I said, let's talk. And there were tears, and there was talk, and there was apology, and there was forgiveness, and there were embraces, and it was a great moment. It suddenly dawned on me, Kurt hasn't been involved in any of this. He's working. And so we drove over there. I hammered on the door. It was late afternoon, and he opened the door. And he said, I'm having such a hard afternoon. And I just grabbed him, and I just held him. And in a rare moment, this strapping young man began to cry. I said, let's go talk. So we walked in there and we sat down in the boardroom. All these great missionary pictures around us. You know, swords from the Alcas and shields from some tribe in Irianjaya. And sitting there in a little cluster was a Swindoll family making things right. Managing my home. I canceled my trip to the Midwest. I took the next Sunday off, confessed to the board why, and we took off together to build some fences and some bridges and to reestablish some walls. If I live to be 110, as much as I love to preach, it is that scene on Saturday morning that gives me the right to talk today about this subject. If I don't take time for that, I have no right to take your time for this. Father, I thank you for your personal presence this day. I thank you for the value of a home, for the role that it fills in our lives, for the significance of time spent with a mate, for forgiveness, for grace, for sensitivity, for understanding, for tact, for the character of Jesus Christ at work between husbands and wives, parents and children. Thank you in Christ's name. Amen.